All right. Really glad to be here. This has been a lot of fun. I'm here all week, so if you want to come, if you have time to come chat, if you want to ask me some questions, I'll be here through the end of Friday. All right.
Please turn on your microphone.
She warned me she was going to do that, so. Okay, so just to kind of start off, I'm going to want you to kind of imagine, suppose everything in the universe, including us, were made out of bowling balls. And now suppose we were surrounded by a sea of slow-moving ping pong balls. The question is, could we ever tell? And kind of more abstractly, is it possible to influence without being influenced? So what I'm interested in is what are the experimental limits, the limits on experimental physicists for identifying sectors of the universe to which we are weakly coupled. So there's a lot of things, dark matter, supersymmetry, and on and on, but I think this is a really important kind of abstract question. So the outline of this talk is I'm going to start with this decoherence without classical influence idea. Then I'm going to totally shift gears because I'm going to have to introduce some basic stuff about low mass dark matter. Then I'm going to pull them together. We're going to talk about collisional decoherence of that low mass dark matter and the feasibility and contributing effects for detecting it. Then I'm going to put up the nice plots about the search potential and finally conclude. So this is the experiment that I really love, and I think everyone should know about because it was super cool. In this case, this is collisional decoherence. They're doing an interference experiment with these C70 fullerenes. This is actually C60, but very, very similar, which are these big, heavy objects, heavy molecules on that scale, and they're doing quantum interference experiments with them. And what they do is that they allow them to be decohered while they're doing this experiment by methane, which is much, much lighter, by just releasing a methane gas into the chamber. And the point is that the deflection, when the methane causes this decoherence, the deflection of the fullerenes is essentially nil. So this is the kind of experimental setup. You have your fullerenes coming from the left side. They go through what are effectively two slits. In the real experiment, there's many slits, but that's the idea. And on their way to trying to produce a fringe pattern on the right side of the screen, they have the potential for being decohered by the methane. And the key idea here is that as you vary the gas pressure in the experiment, this controls the interference fringe visibility. So this is the plot. So on the left side of the plot, you have the visibility on a log scale. And on the right side of the plot, you have just the pressure of that methane in the experiment. And so the visibility, right, is just the amplitude over the average. And you can see what, those are your fringe patterns in the little inset there. And the first one is high visibility. The second one is low visibility. And you can just see that as you turn up the methane pressure, the visibility and the count rate both fall exponentially. And the thing about this experiment is that sufficiently dense methane will just knock the fullerenes out of the experiment. So the experiment kind of can't go on once the methane reaches a certain degree of density. What if you were to dial down the mass of the methane in your head while holding their velocities constant? The increasing methane density is still going to suppress the fringe visibility, but now the fullerenes, right, they would remain totally undeflected if you bring the mass low enough. And the count rate, meaning the number of fullerenes that are hitting the screen per second, should remain constant as you adjust the pressure. So this naturally suggests the massless limit, right? If you think about it, you should be able to detect the presence of arbitrarily light particles transferring arbitrary little momentum and energy by the decoherence that they cause. And so the thing I'm going to basically try to convince you of, this is the tagline, is that quantum measurements can detect particles which are classically undetectable. And so getting back to the bowling ball picture of the universe, we have our bowling ball guy, which was a Google image search for these nice glasses that turned out perfect. And he's doing a bowling ball interferometry experiment. And his question is whether that little orange box is filled with ping pong balls or not, that he is unable to detect because they're so light, they transfer so little momentum. But when he removes the door, They cause decoherence, and you see the fringe of visibility go away. And he can conclude, ah, there were ping pong balls in there. Okay, so now I want to talk about how this might apply to dark matter. So I'm going to give a quick introduction to that. So we have observations from many places that suggest there's new and non-baryonic forms of gravitating matter. And the evidence comes from a bunch of different scales, basically subgalactic, so still much larger than the solar system, but up to the galaxy and then above. So probably the one everybody hears the most about, or the original one, was these galactic rotation curves. So you just have the velocity that things are spinning around the distance from the center of the galaxy on the x-axis there, and their velocity. And what you expect just by looking at the visible matter is one curve. The thing you actually get is another curve, which suggests that there's more matter in the galaxy than we know about. You also have really striking evidence from the Bullitt cluster. This is one of my favorite pictures in science, actually. So here, this is where they looked at two colliding galaxy clusters. And the whole idea was to really see if there was, is it dark matter that we just, is there really some new mass there, or is it just maybe we don't know much about gravity? And this was neat because they said, well, we want to separate these two things. And so you look out for where you have two galaxy clusters that collided. So the purple are these X-ray emissions, and they tell you where the hydrogen gas in the galaxy that makes up the bulk of the visible normal matter in the galaxy. And then the blue is the gravitational lensing in the image that you get by looking through the galaxy clusters and looking at things behind them. And there you can just basically measure how much lensing is going on and thereby infer the mass density. So here, the result of this collision of these two galaxy clusters is that the normal matter gets held up, but the dark matter, which is weakly interacting, passes straight through and is causing the bulk of the gravitational lensing. And then there's, like I said, there's many other places, but another big clue for dark matter comes from large-scale structure. And this is basically when you simulate the universe and you ask, you know, on what scales does matter tend to clump up, and you run simulations of it. It doesn't work with the kind of mass we can see in there, but adding dark matter brings the simulations much, much closer to reality. So the problem is that basically all this evidence is essentially gravitational. People have a bunch of competing ideas over what is causing all of this gravitating. And any kind of candidate explanation that you come up with has to satisfy a really wide range of experiments and observations stretching back decades. They still routinely cite experiments that took place in the 60s and the 70s. And most of these constraints you get end up being really indirect and model independent. It's really relatively few model independent results. But we do have a generic local prediction that really doesn't matter too much about what you think about dark matter. And it's that there's this spherical, virialized halo of dark matter enveloping the Milky Way. So dark matter is the blue, visible matter is the white. Basically, it should be isotropic in the galactic rest frame. It should have like a Maxwellian velocity distribution, so basically thermal. And then you can just directly extract the density from looking at things like the rotation curves and its typical velocity just from the virial theorem. And anytime you see limits or statements made by underground detectors or any other kind of direct detection, they always assume this kind of a distribution. So it's on pretty solid footing and not well disputed. And it's important that it's based only on like local present day observations. So you don't have to believe any stuff about cosmology. You can just look out there right now and infer that this is going on. So the conventional way people go about detecting dark matter, right, is they get a big container of normal matter. They squint and they look really, really hard at it. And then they see, you know, what they want to do is they want to see a dramatic nuclear recoil and enjoy the fame and accolades that would come with that. But most often, nothing happens. And so what you do is you establish new exclusion limits. So the mass density and the distribution of the dark matter velocities is roughly known. So any choice of a dark matter mass, and here, dark matter could be made of multiple particles, but you can just say, well, just whatever one makes up a good chunk, 30% or 50% of the mass, pick that as at least it's there. If you choose a mass, this sets a number density and a flux based off of that mass density. And then you just count the number of nucleons in your container and the exposure time that you didn't have a scattering event. And that lets you set limits on the dark matter nucleon scattering cross-section. The reason, and people usually concentrate on this spin independence, so no complicated interactions with the nucleon spin, and with elastic scattering. And we'll see that elastic scattering is going to be particularly important for us. And so the key plot of all these experiments is just this parameter space of dark matter mass and cross-section. So this is the kind of plots you get when you're looking for WIMPs. And so on the x-axis here, you have the mass. On the y-axis, you have this scattering cross-section. And as you make more and more sensitive detectors, you can just rule out smaller and smaller cross-sections. But of course, for sufficiently small cross-sections, you wouldn't expect to see anything in your detector, so you can't rule them out. And the key thing to take away from this plot is just that all these limits that they're able to set just totally evaporate once you start considering dark matter masses below a GeV. So these conventional experiments are blind there. Now, if you're looking for WIMPs, this is actually okay, because WIMPs have a story that goes on in the early universe, and the Lee-Weinberg bound basically means that WIMPs can't be below roughly 2 GeV. But the experimental exclusions on traditional WIMPs are becoming uncomfortable. We haven't seen them for a long time, and experiments are getting better and better. The Lux results are the most recent ones that have come out. And there are a lot of sub-GeV models, that is, dark matter models with masses below a GeV, that are not constrained by the Lee-Weinberg bound. So the question is, can you look for lighter masses? But as that plot indicated, it's going to be very hard, right? So the nucleon mass is about a GeV. And the energy transfer goes like m squared v squared over big M, so big M being the nucleon mass. So the minimum sensitivity of the experiments is about 1 keV of energy transfer. And this corresponds to the dark matter mass weighing roughly what a nucleon weighs. But if you thought about an MeV dark matter candidate, so roughly an electron, two electron masses, that's only going to deposit in the neighborhood of a milliEV. And if you wanted to think about a keV candidate, you're talking about nanoEV. So they're really impossible to detect with any of the current methods that people think about. Okay, so now we want to connect this to collisional decoherence. And do I have any questions so far? Okay. Again, we're going to be thinking, most of the time we're going to be thinking just in terms of like a Max Zender interferometer. And so normally you think about this interferometer, you essentially prepare an initial state of a superposition, and then your final state just evolves, passes through the interferometer unperturbed, and effectively when you put in that last beam splitter, you make a measurement in this plus minus basis. And if you orient your beam splitter just right, you should be able to get almost all of the events to end up in one detector and almost none of them to end up in the other detector. But you can imagine a dark matter particle coming in. If you want to, you can imagine it fired out of a gun. It starts in some in state, initially unentangled. It scatters into a conditional state where you're conditional on the atom, say, being in that's passing through this interferometer, being in the left or the right arm. But the point is that for low masses of the dark matter, right, the dark matter just scatters off, and the atom continues on. So the NL state on the top and the second line are the same state, or roughly the same state, high overlap. But now when you make your second measurement, you're now going to get about a 50-50 distribution, right? This is the sign of decoherence. This is, of course, if those conditional out states have very little overlap. So that's the kind of signal that we're looking for. Now the strengths of the suppression is going to depend on the quality of the which path information that's recorded in the dark matter out states. The one I just showed there was when you have full information. So single scattering event suffices to decohere. And this is the case when you have short wavelength dark matter. We're talking about the de Broglie wavelength. And in this case, you get a single event that causes zero fringe visibility after just one scattering event. But you can also consider other dark matter that has a longer wavelength, in which case, if it's very long wavelength, the overlap is actually very close to one. So you have just a little bit of decoherence, and you only have a slight suppression of the fringe visibilities. And so it actually requires many scattering events to decohere, but you can imagine this by just upping the flux, and the decoherence factors here are just going to multiply. And even if you have just slight decoherence from one scattering event, if you have enough of them, they can become very small very quickly.
What's the wavelength of the dark matter being compared with?
It's the separation of the superposition. So the width, I think it's actually the next slide. Yeah, is the width of the interferometer here. So this is kind of a toy model of most of the experiments, but it has all the key features. So we're just thinking about a single nucleon placed in a superposition of two wave packets separated by some distance delta x, and that's the important thing to compare the dark matter wavelength to, and exposed to the dark matter for some time t. Okay. So collisional decoherence, just as a phenomena, is well known and pretty well understood. And so we concentrate on just this kind of this two-state subspace. So in that basis, after being exposed to collisional decoherence, the density matrix of the nucleon is going to look like that, where that decoherence factor is the exponential of this F term integrated, where this is the, so that's the decoherence factor, and this is the decoherence rate. So it's something measured in Hertz. Okay, and of course, you just integrate it over time to get a dimensionless number. And here, just to give you a flavor of what goes into this, you're integrating over all the possible incoming dark matter momentum. You're weighting it by the dark matter phase space density. You integrate over all possible outstates for the dark matter. This term here is going to be set by the overlap of the outstates, so there's the overlap of those two conditional states of the dark matter. And then, of course, you're also going to be sensitive to the differential cross-section of that scattering process. So decoherence is going to be effective when the real part of that term F is much, much larger than the inverse time that the nucleon is exposed for. In order to do these kind of calculations, you got to assume something about the scattering cross-section. We're going to take S-wave scattering with no strong momentum dependence. Now, it turns out that for our purposes, the S-wave should definitely, almost certainly, dominate the partial wave expansion anytime the dark matter wavelength is going to be long compared to the length range of the force that it interacts with. So unless for these light dark matter particles, which have surprisingly long wavelength, unless there's a new force that's very long range and would really surprise people, the S wave should dominate. And if you modify this angular cross section, it's really only given order unity correction and the kind of things we're going to be looking at orders of magnitude here. So really isn't a big deal. So there's a few more kind of contributing effects I have to discuss just to make sense of what you can say about the dark matter that you exclude. So the first obvious problem, right, is how to tell whether anomalous decoherence you see is really caused by the dark matter. So I'm going to delay that for a few slides, but it's a crucial question. But the second obvious problem is that dark matter collisions are very rare. So these conventional experiments that look for WIMPs look for just like a handful of collisions amongst 10 to the 28 nucleons. So like they have big tanks that weigh like a ton, exposed for 10 to the 6 seconds. I mean, they have these month-long, year-long exposure times. So the question is it really feasible to look at 10 to the 0 nucleons exposed to 10 to the 0 seconds? Well, the first thing you have going for you is in this mass range we're going to be concentrating on, which is below a GeV, the existing experimental limits are 10 to the 21 to the 10 to the 29 times weaker than where WIMPs concentrate on. So this is we're really blind to this area. But that's still not enough. And so there's a bunch of neat things that come into play. So the first thing is this profound property of decoherence. It only takes a single environmental particle to decohere an arbitrarily large object, which is one, you know, a lot of people say this is why you don't see Schrodinger's cat walking around all the time. So if you put a large object into a superposition made of many nucleons, then the dark matter can scatter off of any of them. The effect of decoherence factor is raised to the power n, where big n is just the number of nucleons in the object. And so the decoherence rate just increases proportional to n for a given dark matter, given cross-section, these kind of things. So your sensitivity to cross-section increases proportional to n. And so this is actually an example. I'm not going to talk about it, but this is an example of like a decoherent Heisenberg limit for matter and interferometry. It's very analogous. But the problem is that we want to think that creating these large superpositions is very hard. Won't n be very small? And of course, no new matter interferometry, modern matter interferometry, is totally awesome. So in Vienna, they do all sorts of great stuff. They've superposed molecules of 10 to the 4 AMU. They expect the next generation of interferometers to push 10 to the 7. So these are really massive things that they're doing. It's very cool. And that's not all. We have another thing going for us, which is an effect called coherent elastic scattering. So when the dark matter de Broglie wavelength is larger than the distance between nucleons, it scatters coherently. So this is an effect that's well known from X-ray neutron small angle scattering, and also back when people were looking for relic neutrinos, or they were thinking about how they would detect relic neutrinos, they had to play around with this coherent elastic scattering stuff. And during that, when you have these sufficiently long wavelengths, the dark matter doesn't scatter off any single nucleon. It scatters off all of them. So it's kind of like a Mossbauer effect. And this, it decreases the energy transfer, but it increases the scattering rate. And it gives you actually a sensitivity boost by a factor of n. One way to think about it is just that if the dark matter can't see the difference between the nucleons, because the dark matter wavelength is too long, then all the outstates add together coherently. So you basically, your amplitude for the outstate is multiplied by n rather than the probability being multiplied by n. So then when you square it to get a probability, you get n squared. So it gives you an additional factor of n compared to what you would think from just adding them up incoherently. So for just to kind of anchor you, if you're thinking about dark matter masses below a GeV, they're always scattering coherently across a nucleus. It's at that point, the de Broglie wavelength easily covers the nuclear size. Once you get down, start considering dark matter masses around an MeV, you'll start getting scattering across multiple nuclei, because that's basically just when the dark matter mass or dark matter wavelength approaches an angstrom, right? And of course, we have just to remind you, you know, the velocity distribution is roughly fixed. Turn the dark matter mass down, we're talking about longer de Broglie wavelengths. And then once you get down below a KeV, this is going to scatter coherently off the entire object, any object that we're going to superpose anytime soon. And so that, once you're below a KeV, you get fully coherent elastic scattering. In the intermediate region, there are complicated interference effects. But luckily, it's a very easy way to think about it. There's a good approximation that the boost is proportional to the number of nucleons in a coherent scattering volume, which is just, you just think about a volume that's about the size of the reduced wavelength of the dark matter, and the number of nucleons that fit in that volume is going to tell you what the rough boost is in total scattering cross-section compared to an incoherent estimate. So you can see all the gory details in the paper. There's actually some neat physics in there that was kind of fun to learn about, if painful. And then there's another thing I need to introduce here before I can put up plots, is this idea of the dark matter wind. So the dark matter velocity distribution, it's roughly thermal and isotropic in the galactic rest frame. So the typical speed of the dark matter particle and the Earth as they go around the sun are both about 230 kilometers a second. The dark matter is going in all directions. The Earth's going in one direction. And so observers on the Earth, they experience like an apparent dark matter wind opposite the Earth's motion in the galaxy. So this leads to a phase shift in the interferometer. So in addition to this decoherence effect, we're also going to get a phase shift. And this is going to be basically the exact same phase shift people see in like atom interferometry experiments where they use it to detect the force of gravity. In this case, it's the force of the dark matter wind. And this gives you a nice smooth link between, if you want to call, sometimes people call these quantum enhanced measurements, when you do these weak force detection to detect weak forces with atom interferometry. And this is kind of a decoherent quantum enhanced measurement, and it makes a smooth transition between the two. It's very neat. But this is the force of the dark matter wind. It's very physical and cool. So that will come up in the plots. Okay, so now I'm going to get back to this original question I put aside for a second, which was anomalous decoherence. If you see anomalous decoherence, you build an experiment, you think you've eliminated all the decoherence, but you still see some, how would you ever be able to confidently attribute that to dark matter? There's many possible sources. A massive challenge of building these experiments is identifying and defeating one level of decoherence after the other, where they figure out and understand one type of decoherence, and they tweak their experiment to get rid of it, and then they have a new level of decoherence that comes up, and they have to keep beating them one after another. So if you just see anomalous decoherence, it doesn't imply dark matter, of course. But the first thing to notice is that the inverse statement is true. A successful interferometer, you just get the interferometer and it runs once and it sees an interference pattern, that implies that all sources of decoherence have been eliminated. So you can start, as soon as you get a cool enough interferometer running, you can start eliminating dark matter parameter space. And this establishes robust exclusion limits. But now we want to think about the other case. If we see anomalous decoherence, we think it might be due to dark matter, how could we convince ourselves of that? So the first thing you would do is you would try varying parameters of the experiment. So the spatial extent of the superposition, that delta x, the exposure time by just either lengthening the experiment or slowing down the molecules and exposing them to the dark matter for longer. You could vary the elemental composition of the object, just try making it out of different stuff. And you could even better vary the isotopic composition of the elements. And this is cool because, right, general sources of decoherence will not have the same dependence on these parameters. The isotopic one is especially a neat thing to think about. I don't know how hard that would be. But basically, all the sources of decoherence that we expect, normal sources of decoherence, will come from outside the atom, right? So if you vary the isotopic composition, we wouldn't really expect that to change much how exterior sources of decoherence come about. But of course, if you're scattering off the dark matter and you're just sticking more nucleons into the atoms, then you'll get an enhanced, increased decoherence rate from that. And so that would be a neat signal. And then the other big thing you can do, and this is very important, is if you can, you want to try varying the expected dark matter flux. One thing to try is just shield the experiment from dark matter, right? You can imagine running your interferometer, it sees decoherence, you take a big block of lead, you move it over top the interferometer, the interference pattern comes back, the decoherence goes away, over, back. This is good evidence that you're shielding the decoherence source. Additionally, the strength of the dark matter wind is going to vary by several percentage points over the year due to the Earth's motion around the sun. So the dark matter wind will get stronger and weaker. This will affect the decoherence rate. And there's also this really neat effect. When the dark matter wavelength isn't too short compared to this delta x, the separation and superposition, then the orientation of the interferometer arms will give an order unity change. So interferometers are naturally directional dark matter detectors, which don't exist right now. All these WIMP detectors, everything you see, they can't tell where the dark matter's coming from. And this is very cool. You rotate the interferometer, it will the degree of decoherence will change depending on its orientation with respect to the dark matter wind. And this can give unambiguous evidence that the signal is coming from like a fixed direction in the galaxy. It's not coming from something on Earth. It's not coming from the sun. It's definitely coming from something extrasolar. So that's a very, very neat aspect of using interferometers to look for dark matter. Okay, so now we're going to actually say what we need to say to put up the exclusion plots. So we're going to concentrate on this mass cross-section plane as our parameter space. Oops. The reason we're going to kind of take a lower bound of just looking at down at about 10 eV for the dark matter mass. Once you get below that, the occupation number dark matter in the galaxy in order to explain the mass that we need to see there. That approaches unity. You start seeing coherence effects. Basically, you can't fit enough fermions in there. If it's bosonic, complicated things start happening with coherent waves. And we're going to set the upper bound at 100 MeV. Any higher, and if the dark matter mass is any higher than 100 MeV, you really might as well use a conventional detector at that point because they would start working. So that's the range. It's a pretty big range. So like we said, above a GeV, the cross-sections are experimentally constrained to be very low. But for low-mass dark matter, these constraints are very weak. So I'm just going to put them up there, what we know right now. The only direct detection constraints, I shouldn't even say direct detection. The only direct detection constraints below 100 MeV come from something called the X-ray quantum calorimeter experiment, which was pretty neat. It ran on a sounding rocket, and it was like a very sensitive calorimeter that they exposed to space at high altitude. So it was able to get a lower energy threshold than most of the conventional direct detection methods. And there's another generic robust constraint that if you just look at the stability, if you require stability of the dark matter halo from collisions as parts of the dark matter pass through the Milky Way disk, and also if you look at the temperature of interstellar hydrogen, you get some very robust constraints, but very weak constraints on the maximum cross-section the dark matter has with nucleons. And then there's some additional constraints we can get in thermal dark matter scenarios. So thermal dark matter, it's a popular property for dark matter models if you want to talk about it in the early universe, because it means if you assume it's thermal, then you can actually say a few things about what it does in the early universe, and it applies to WIMPs. So in this case, you're assuming that dark matter was in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the contents of the universe at early cosmological times. As the universe expanded, the density of dark matter drops low enough that the interactions become too rare, and so it decouples. And then the dark matter in this story kind of streams around and clumps into the galaxies today. So if you make this assumption that dark matter was thermal, and there are plenty of models where dark matter is thermal, it influences a bunch of cosmological and astrophysical parameters. And the important ones for what we're going to be looking for, something called the Lyman alpha force, which is spectroscopy, basically. Large-scale structure, which again was those simulations that people do that look how galaxies and supergalaxies and everything clump together on large scales. And then the CMB actually is also going to be important. And then finally, there's not many low-mass dark matter models out there. People generally assume they'd be pretty depressingly undetectable, although there has been a recent increase in model building, probably due to the negative WIMP results. So people do look them. There's not a whole lot of them. The best known are probably these strongly interacting massive particles, actually. They're going to be characterized by a particular ratio of the mass to cross-section. Could help explain something that's called the cusp problem for dark matter simulations within galaxies. Not really attractive these days for the large masses, which was the one that people originally thought of, but it provides a good landmark for plausible theories. So this is kind of where you stand before we look at interferometry. So these are those robust exclusions. We know dark matter is definitely not there. Again, dark matter mass on the x-axis, y-axis is its cross-section with nucleons. These hashed regions are excluded for thermal models. If you assume dark matter is thermal, then the Lyman alpha spectra and the CMB and large-scale structure, these things are excluded. This is kind of a plausible landmark for theories that people have actually taken the time to construct. That's the Thompson scattering cross section. That's an E&M cross section. So it's very big. That's just to give you a landmark. This logarithmic scale on the y-axis is like really covers a lot of ground there. So that gives you a landmark. This intermediate region, that's not excluded, but nobody has many good models for, is kind of a no man's land. I offered cold hard cash to the postdocs, the particle physics postdocs at Stanford, if they could come up with a model that fit in there somewhere. And they could neither come up with it, or I was going to give them the money if they could exclude it. And I I couldn't. So it's unclear what would be in there. But that's where we're going to start off looking right now. So what can interferometers do? I need to look at some benchmark experiments that people are going to be doing in the kind of next generation of these interferometers to get a sense of the sensitivity. So the first one is going to be something called the Atomic Gravitational Wave Interferometric Sensor Satellite. So this is a proposal. They're looking for gravitational waves, and they're using single atoms, so you won't get this coherence boost that I talked about, but they're doing it in the open vacuum of space. And so this is the site where, you know, I'm taking this existing experiment, asking how sensitive is it to dark matter. So this is the exclusions that we had before, and this is where the Aegis satellite would sit. So not super exciting, especially if you really think dark matter is thermal. The next experiment is called it's OTIMA, the Optical Time Domain Ionizing Matter Wave Interferometer. This is one of the ones in the ART group in Vienna, which these guys are the world leaders in matter interferometry. And this is basically just improved technology over what they already have. And so these guys, I trust these guys can do what they say they can do because they proved themselves in the past. Now the problem with this experiment, this OTIMA experiment, is that atmospheric shielding is a real concern. The first one was the satellite that we were talking about. But the bounds on dark matter that we're thinking of here are so weak that the atmosphere actually provides a significant degree of shielding if you're considering cross-sections that are very high. The atmosphere works out to be, I think, roughly a meter of lead in terms of number of nucleons per square area. And so you can't look for the dark matter, obviously, if it's stopped by the atmosphere. And that's going to be important for this particular experiment, the next two experiments. You have some alternatives. If you really wanted to do this, you could put it in a high-altitude balloon. You could put it on a sounding rocket or go to a satellite. Or you could just try to be really awesome and create a superposition so large it would be sensitive. I shouldn't say smaller dark matter. I should say smaller cross-section dark matter. But anyways, the point is it's not going to be possible for the terrestrial experiments in the foreseeable future to get around this atmospheric shielding problem. So for right now, for the next two experiments, I'm just going to assume we basically put them on a sounding rocket that gets up to 200 kilometers and see what they would be sensitive to if you just lifted them up that high. So this is where we were before, and you add this OTIMA experiment, which is one that they expect to have running in just a couple years here. The neat thing about this experimental exclusion is that there's two parts, right? You have this is the part causing decoherence, but then there's also this part from the dark matter wind that's just that phase shift. I drew a line to delineate it, but there's kind of a smooth bleeding between the two. Of course, when the decoherence is strong, you can't see the phase shift because it gets decohered. But when the decoherence gets weak, you can start seeing that phase shift, and so when you turn your interferometer, you will be able to see the effects of the dark matter wind. So that would be pretty neat to see. But again, this is not the experiment they're running. This is if you took the experiment they're running and put it up high above the atmosphere, or above most of the atmosphere. And finally, the third main experiment I'm going to be looking at, although we're going to talk about a fourth one, is one I didn't really have a good name for it. I just called it Nanosphere, because they're going to be taking these little balls of silica, roughly 40 nanometers, and they're going to suspend them optically and basically cool them down to their ground state. So this is very different than normal interferometry, where you're sending things through slits. You're literally cooling, suspending something, cooling it down to its ground state, releasing it from the trap, allowing it to expand, and actually kind of producing slits by just shooting lasers at it. It's pretty cool. I think they're neat. And it would look like this on this exclusion plot, where things start to get interesting. But again, it's at 200 kilometers. But again, and you do see the separation between the decoherence effects and the phase shift effects. So now I'm going to talk about the DECIDE experiment. This one's a little more speculative. This is an experiment that they are talking about. They're in the process of it is proposals for the European Space Agency. They have a couple of publications out about how they want to do it. It would probably fly in the mid-2020s. But this would be kind of similar to the Nanosphere proposal. And again, it would be taking a ball of silica, suspending it. But there's a lot of advantages that you get by going to space. Not even in terms of dark matter, in terms of avoiding atmospheric shielding. You can just make larger superpositions in space because you're separated from all sorts of vibrations and other terrible issues. And so compared to these Earth-bound ones, you get really great increases in the time span that we expect, the mass that we expect to be able to superpose, and how far apart we expect to be able to separate it. And so what you end up getting is, depending on which part of these masses you're looking at, you end up getting like 7 to 10 orders of magnitude compared to these terrestrial experiments. And it can really do really cool stuff. So this right here, right, this is, just to give you an idea, this is the kind of region where you're talking about solar neutrino cross-sections. So these are really low cross-sections. So you become sensitive to some really, really neat stuff here. And then just to give you an idea of how important this progress in mass is for dark matter sensitivity, I'm going to look at just some, these are just some existing interferometers, right? People have interfered neutrons, helium, these C70 fullerenes I described at the beginning, and then these derivatives of the fullerenes that are even larger. And I'm also, on this next plot, I'm going to show you three choices of the OTMA masses. So it's that experiment. So like 10 to the 4 AMU has been done. 10 to the 6 is hard, but is likely to be achieved in a few years. 10 to the 8 probably can't be done on Earth, but they're already thinking about satellites. It would be a separate satellite experiment that they already want to do. So this is a selection of them. I'm just going to go through, I'll try to not scroll through them too fast. So these guys at the top, these are all old experiments with single atoms, or in this case, a single neutron, and these are the kind of cross sections you're sensitive to. And just keep in mind how crazy this log plot is, right? I mean, the number of orders of magnitude here you're going through is incredible. So OTMA 4 is roughly 10,000 AMU, 10,000 protons and neutrons. These are the C70 fullerenes. This is the fullerene derivative, which is basically, you can see, it's just a fullerene with a bunch of stuff stuck on top of it. This would be the OTMA experiment with 10 to the 6 AMU, so larger balls. And these are, if you're interested, these are going to be clusters of gold. Is probably what they're going to use. And then this nanosphere experiment would be even bigger and better. And so you can just see that this progression, as you go to higher masses, yields dramatic increases in your sensitivity. OTMA 8 right up there. And so just to kind of remind you, the WIMPs are at these larger masses. So here you're talking about here is a MeV. The WIMPs are start at a GeV and go above, and these are the typical WIMP exclusions. So if you can really get this DECIDE satellite to go, you're doing really cool stuff. It's 15, 20 orders of magnitude larger than what people could do before.
What is causing the bends at around 10 to the 6 EV?
Yeah, 10 to the 6, right. So what happens here is, this is where the dark, again, when you go to low masses, larger de Broglie wavelength, this is when the wavelength is long enough to get coherence across multiple atoms. So that's basically when the dark matter wavelength approaches an angstrom, you start getting stronger effects. This upturn is where the dark matter wavelength becomes longer than the width of the superposition. It's harder for dark matter to see the separation, and so your sensitivity gets less. And again, so everything except the DECIDE satellite everything except the DECIDE satellite is published. This is unpublished. We're still working on it. Okay, so I think this stuff is neat. This next generation of matter interferometers will probably need to get above the atmosphere to see dark matter. But this rapid improvement in masses translates into a squared increase in sensitivity. So big masses are really sensitive. It's very cool. satellite experiments will be able to open up five orders of magnitude previously inaccessible dark matter mass. Now, the other thing you can do, again, this is just kind of stuff that hasn't been fleshed out. You can relax the requirement for complete decoherence. Everything that I've shown you before is when the lines are drawn when you expect the object to be decohered when you send it through the interferometer. Like every time it goes through, it gets decohered. But if you just look for statistics, if you say, you know, say if I'm talking about a situation where I can shield the dark matter, I can just look for tiny changes in the decoherence rate when I move a block of shielding above or away from the interferometer. And you can pick up Sirius, these like root M statistics. So here M is just the number of objects that you pass through the interferometer. You can pick up a lot of power by doing that. So here this is, let's see, the statistical enhancements for these experiments. These are just based off of the kind of rates at which they produce superpositions as described in those papers. So if you just take these boosts, then you can really dramatically increase, potentially dramatically increase your sensitivity that way. Okay, so I'm just going to just quickly summarize here. Really, mostly I'm just talking about what else maybe you could use this stuff for. So more outlook than summary. These are like free results from experiments with existing unrelated motivations, right? People just wanted to make these superpositions because they were cool. So I think it would be neat if you said, what could you do if you actually explicitly designed this experiment for dark matter? And then what about other experiments? What about other types of superpositions that you could create that would be sensitive? So you could think about the electron dark matter scattering cross-section that people can write down models where the dark matter interacts with electrons, but maybe not so much with neutrons. And you would look at superconducting qubits in space. You could also look at these massive superposed oscillators. So these are these optical mechanical oscillators that people look at. These are actually interesting because they have much more mass, so they're much more sensitive. In principle, they seem like they should be much more sensitive, but they're actually not separated on the scale of the object. It's like the center of mass separation in the superposition. It's much smaller than the object itself. And if the dark matter scatters off of a location in space that's common to the two halves of the superposition, then it can't tell the difference. So there's two effects there, and there's some complicated. Like again, the mass goes up, but the visibility may go down. And so what your sensitivity is in that case, it looks complicated. There's a bunch of things that need things to go on. On the other hand, if you might be thinking about BECs, because a lot of people want to send BECs into space, normal BEC interferometers, they don't work so well. They're not entangled, so they don't get the coherence boost. Basically, with a BEC, you have a bunch of atoms in the same state, but they're not in an entangled state. Maybe if you squeeze them or put them into noon states, but the prospects for reaching large amounts of squeezing are not very good. So BECs are kind of not optimistic about those. Now the other thing I want to just bring up real quick before I go is about other types of searches you could be doing. So you could be looking for different kinds of dark matter, axion dark matter, or other kinds of cases where the dark matter is a boson, behave like a coherent wave in our galaxy. Relic neutrinos are something that everybody would love to get their hands on because they would be an unbelievable window into the very, very early universe. I think relic neutrinos have been streaming around completely. They've decoupled from everything since about 20 minutes after the Big Bang. And so they would carry around information about that time period. And they have these notoriously tiny momentum transfers. And it's unclear. I don't think you could detect relic neutrinos with this. But I'm not sure yet. Could you see evidence of gravitons, just graviton existence, not as a graviton detector? Probably not anytime soon. It turns out what you would need, if you have relativistic Planck mass superposition, so Planck mass is very large, 10 to the 19 AMU, much, much larger than the experiments we're talking about, and you can move them around relativistically, they decohere through gravitational bremsstrahlung, actually radiating individual gravitons. So I have some musings about that, if you're interested. But I don't know. I think there's a bunch of different things, different directions you could go with this. So anyways, the claim I want to leave you with is that detecting new particles of forces through decoherence is a fundamentally different technique for detection. It lets you do stuff you couldn't do before. In particular, you can detect classically undetectable phenomena, stuff that deposits essentially no momentum, no energy, no anything. Insofar as you kind of, this is a good way to define kind of the classicality of states. If you just think about Hilbert space and which states are classical, the stability and the presence of decoherence can be used to define the classicality. Schrodinger's cat is not stable. It's not a classical state. Nice wave packets are stable to collisional decoherence. So defining classicality in that way, the most non-classical states will be the most sensitive to decoherence, and therefore are the most sensitive to these weak or soft phenomena that we might be looking for. So I think this is like new motivation for pursuing macroscopic quantum superpositions of all kinds. And so finally, the inspirational, this is the last slide, is that the guys who discovered the cosmic microwave background, they weren't looking for it when they found it in 1965. They thought it was just noise in their microwave antenna. Originally, they thought it was bird droppings. And they saw it first. They saw the CMB first because, for one reason, because they built the world's most sensitive detector of its type. The progress in interferometry is really very rapid. They are the world's most sensitive detectors of decoherence, and they're getting more and more sensitive. So I think everyone should totally keep your eyes open for things that you new things you could be seeing that we couldn't see before. Thanks very much for your attention.
Any questions for Jess? So this is a really innovative idea, and it's very cool. But I'm surprised that there's such a gap in the mass range below 100 MeV. I mean, so you're right that the direct detection sensitivity falls off dramatically.
Right.
But if you're down in the sub-100 MeV range or so, you're susceptible to all kinds of constraints coming from collider production, for example. You're susceptible to constraints from rare meson decays.
Well, so these always are very model dependent, right? So they come from, you assume the dark matter interact.
Well, they're model dependent up to the same assumptions that you're making, because you're assuming that you can scatter off of some kind of nucleus with the dark matter particles.
Yep.
You're committed to an interaction that has some sort of terminal Lagrangian that has two dark matter particles and two nucleons. And that's the same process that you would have if you had, say, a meson that decayed to two dark matter particles.
I have to think about the meson one. Again, these things always turn out to be at totally different kind of energy scales, so that they're not comparable. The accelerator one, I know for sure. It comes from when you take that like that Feynman diagram, right, and you just flip it around, right? Two protons.
So there are a number of different ones. So for example, so if you're talking about the LHC or at LEP, for example, you would have two protons colliding and the same diagram that would be responsible for scattering in an interferometer would also give rise to two dark matter particles. Now, you normally wouldn't be able to see those, but all the energy that was deposited into the collision went into those, but you could also, at higher order in perturbation theory, radiate off a photon or a gluon, and you would see that, and you could correlate that with the energy that was missing in the event. And so that does actually cover the low mass range pretty remarkably.
So that's out of my area of expertise, actually. This is something I've gotten from talking to folks, is that those things are not comparable observations at all.
I would disagree very strongly with that.
Okay. Oh, I should talk more.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you want to go into above the atmosphere just to get away from shielding. But what do you think happens to dark matter in this mass range as it starts hitting the atmosphere? I mean, it's going to slow down, of course. So are you worried about it slowing down to the point where the de Broglie wavelength is so large that it's starting to get into this?
Oh, problem? Yeah. Right. So, I mean, it has to basically slow down. It has to be, it doesn't have to be elastic, but it certainly isn't disrupting the neutrons.
I guess I don't know why you assume it's going to stop.
What's that?
So
if you have this large cross section, it should slow down, right? And then you have to worry about it collecting places.
How's it going to collect?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I'm giving you exclusions as best I can. Right, the easiest way to talk about dark matter and come up with model independent exclusions is by not having to model complicated stuff it does once it enters the atmosphere. If it could come down here and collect, that would be great. And then maybe you could see it some other way.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering why you can't do this on the surface.
I don't know. I mean, can you tell me what you think the dark matter flux would look like? It would just start falling down. I mean, if it slows down in the atmosphere,
you're absolutely going to slow down.
It just comes to some terminal velocity, basically.
Absolutely. So there'll be a drift velocity downward.
Right.
So I am worried that the de Broglie wavelength would be so large at that point for the scattering that.
So you can figure that out, right? So it's the coming in at 230 kilometers a second, and then so you think they're going to be falling at meters a second, something like that. I guess it depends on how often they collide, what terminal velocity they hit. But so you're looking at the increasing de Broglie wavelength by a factor of 1,000 or something like this. So you get much weaker, and you get normally the penalty you pay when the de Broglie wavelength gets long.
That would just shift the sensitivity to higher masses, though, right?
But once you get to very high masses, you might as well use conventional detectors. The penalty you pay is the square of the de Broglie wavelength over the separation. So if you're 1,000 times longer, you get 1,000,000 times weaker.
Any other questions?
So I thought you said somewhere in the middle that there had to be bosons in order to detect them this way.
No. When they're in the range we were looking at, the occupation number is much less than unity. You can think about them as distinguishable particles, and we're just looking at their cross section for elastic scattering. So it works for fermions or bosons. If you wanted to talk about lighter dark matter particles, they have to be bosons, because if they were fermions, you just get degeneracy, and you couldn't pack enough of them into the galaxy in order to account for the mass that you need to be there.
I see.
But of course, once they become a coherent wave, it gets a little more complicated.
I'm curious, in the matter wave experiments, matter interferometry experiments, at what mass does the de Broglie wavelength start to become comparable to the size of the object itself? As you said with the cantilever experiments, you're already sort of in that regime.
Yeah.
Are you just in that
regime,
or?
No, it's not the de Broglie wavelength becoming comparable to the objects themselves. That, during that whole range, again, it was when you're on the right side of the plot. Let me just go back. There we go. At this point, you're getting coherence over just the nucleus, so that the de Broglie wavelength of the dark matter is between, say, a Fermi and an angstrom. When you get to this bend is when the de Broglie wavelength becomes an angstrom, so you start getting coherence effects over multiple atoms. And then down to here is where the de Broglie wavelength starts becoming large compared to the width of the superposition.
So what I was asking about was the de Broglie wavelength of the object in your interferometer, so that the sort of distance between those two bends is going to be determined not by the dark matter, but what's in your interferometer. So
no, because as long as the object is being superposed over a distance larger than the object,
yes,
then you don't have this problem of a dark matter could
right.
You know, collide off a point in space, and you couldn't tell which part of the superposition is coming.
And you're saying that with the cantilever, you do have that problem.
Right.
And my question was just, at what mass scale does that problem arise? Is it sort of slightly beyond
I'm sorry, I apologize.
Right up at the cantilever, like where in that giant gap between buckyballs and cantilevers do we...
Yeah. So it's really determined by how separated is the cantilever getting, right? And the cantilevers, their center of mass motion, or they're complicated actually because they're not They're not position eigenstates, but they're superposing. They're superposing energy eigenstates. But to a rough approximation, you can think about just the center of mass being separated by like a Fermi. So like, you know, in the nuclear scale. And so the dark matter wavelength, right? It hits that nuclear scale. I think out here somewhere. I think they have to start. There's a little region of kind of typical whip searches where they have to worry about the coherent elastic scattering, and so because of that, the oscillators they have that effect that takes place early, and so you have to go below GeV for this to be useful, and so at that point you're already worrying about this effect. Does that make sense? I feel like I haven't quite stated it clearly, but I can rephrase.
If I can ask a follow-up question. I presume that some of the experiments, like the side experiment you're talking about, one of the motivations of them was to try to exclude some of these collapse models that
they
proposed.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious to what extent, this parameter space, how much this parameter space is excluding collapse models? So just give me a flavor for how difficult it is to detect dark matter versus the parameter ranges of the popular collapse models like GRW.
Right. So I know that the difference between there was one proposal for essentially running an experiment that was very much like nanosphere. In space, and maybe just a little bit better. And DECIDE was going to be more sensitive than that one to some ranges of the parameters. So it is in the region. And there are just some of those models where they're just not going to be sensitive no matter what, because set the parameters how you want, you won't be sensitive. But both nanosphere in space and DECIDE, there's a big chunk of the models that they would both be sensitive to. Other than I can't remember the specific parameters off the top of my head. But I think they're mostly concentrating on CSL. Yeah.
You mentioned those SIM models. Why are those called strongly interacting? Is it because of the planar cross sections, or is it really it's probably not strong interaction?
Yeah, so the reason it's not strong. It's not generally thought to be. I don't think they're generally thought to be strong in the sense of the strong force, just strong in the sense of the opposite of the of WIMPs. Although that WIMP is the weak force.
Yeah.
But the reason they're strong is because they're defined by this this ratio between the cross section and the mass. And where people were looking for them before is when you extend this ratio up to here, it's like totally different than where people are looking for WIMPs. And the reason that they maybe ameliorated this cusp problem that people had with simulations in the galaxy, but they also, the reason people looked at them there is because once you get up to this high cross section, they're shielded by the atmosphere, and so most of the experimental exclusions people had didn't apply to SIMPs.
They still interact just electroweakly with the center wall?
I don't think that those models, I think they may have come up with some concrete models, but mostly they were just interested in this ratio of mass to cross section. However, you would model it, they wanted the mass to cross section ratio because it would avoid experimental constraints and because it would solve this cusp problem.
Okay, there are no further questions. Thank you guys again.